Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, Jay, David, and Vicki will visit with Mr. Michael Lester, Christian County grain farmer and secretary of the Kentucky Corn Growers Association. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Vicki thought I was going to say hello again.
I did. Yeah. I was ready.
I did that to her one time.
Yep. Had a little technical difficulties, but we're back on track. And everything's
right.
Good now. So out recording in Gracie, in the greater metropolitan Gracie here in Christian County and Trigg County, right on the line. We're actually in Trigg County now.
Right now.
And but anyway, we're here, and, you know, this is my back door. I grew up here, and my grandparents had a farm here, so have lived here. So it's right in my back door, so it's good to be home. I don't have a very long drive, Vicki.
No, you don't. But I have said this before when I've been down this way. It's a beautiful drive on this road. Mm-hmm. When you turn on this, is it Katie's Road?
68.
Okay.
Yep.
It's a beautiful drive with crops on both sides, and the first time I drove down through here, I think that was one of the things I said when I got down here is how pretty it is, and it's a nice area. It's if you like agriculture, you're in the heart of it right here.
A lot of those crops belong to our guest today too, by the way.
I heard and they look good.
That's right.
That's exactly right. Visiting with us today is Mr. Michael Lester. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. I can hear you loud and clear now. We're glad to have you on the show. You know, I think back, I spent 23 years here in Christian County, and one of my earliest remembrances, we had the Chamber of Commerce does that Chamber Ag breakfast every year. And back in its early days, we had it down in the basement of the Methodist Church. And I can remember you about that time, you were getting ready to finish high school. I was a graduate of Eastern Kentucky University, and you came and sat down with me, and we talked. You thought you might want to go to Eastern, and did for a little while.
I did for a little while. I got my feet wet at Eastern.
I remember that very well, as long ago as that is. But we're glad to have you on the show, and glad to have you a part of agriculture in Western Kentucky.
Well, thank you. Thank you. This is exciting. My office doesn't normally look like this on a daily basis, so it's exciting to have you guys here.
I will say, though, I did notice when I came in, though, but you ended at Murray State University.
My wife and I both ended at Murray State. We're hanging that proudly over there.
Well, I'm a Murray State graduate, too, caught my eye.
We all are in one shape, form, or
that's
fashion.
Right. Yeah,
David
right.
and I both got our master's there as well. I know you did, too.
Yeah, I got my bachelor's and master's both there.
Yep. So I can remember, Micah, we used to play basketball, church league basketball together. I got some stories I could probably break out if I needed to, but probably just going to keep that, and I can't play anymore. I don't know about Micah, but I'm not very good anymore. I just can't get around like I used to.
No, I can't. Church league basketball is probably one of the roughest things I ever did. You know, right. I played football for 6 years in middle school and high school, and church league basketball was probably the roughest thing I ever did.
I told somebody I probably almost been in more fights in church league softball and basketball than any place that I've ever been.
I did get in a fight one time. That's
right. I've seen many a church league softball game in a big discussion in the parking lot.
Yes, that's a good way.
They didn't quite finish the game on the field, you know. They had to carry it over and around the cars. But Mike is part of Lester Farms. I'll let you tell just a little bit about it, but I know you're at least third-generation farmer. I know your dad and your grandfather real well. Had a chance your grandfather stuck his head in the door for just a minute ago, but take just a little bit and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and your family farming operation.
Sure. So, like you said, my name's Micah Lester. I'm a fourth-generation farmer in this area. My grandfather is still with us. Like I said, he stuck his head in here a few minutes ago. He's 90 years old, still riding around. He was back here picking his own sweet corn. I don't know how many 90-year-olds are picking their own sweet corn. He's a tough guy, I tell you what. Yep. And my dad's semi-retired. He's actually out checking beans today. He's semi-retired. My great-grandfather is the one who started it here, and he's passed on several years ago. But we're growers of corn, wheat, and soybeans here in this area. We've dabbled in other things. My dad and grandfather grew tobacco for years. Now, I was by the time they got out of it, I never had a chance to work in it. I was super sad about that.
I bet you were.
But we've had popcorn. We've had canola for a few years. We tried canola, but now we're pretty much corn, wheat, and soybeans. But we're always looking for new opportunities. I'd probably describe us as more progressive. We're not afraid to try new things. We're not the biggest in the area by any means, but we try to really put a focus on quality and try to do a good job. And one of the mantras is always, let's leave the ground better than we found it. You know, just trying to do a good job of taking care of what God's given us. So.
Yeah. I think that's a good mantra to have. You know, a lot of people talk today is about modern agriculture, and they talk about, well, what are they putting on the land? What are they doing here? What are they doing there? And if most folks really got a chance to sit down and discuss that with our modern-day grain farmers, all farmers, in fact, they'd know that you look at soil as your number one resource that you have. It's literally what makes your living.
It is. It's our bank account. I mean, that's you know, we invest in that. We try to take care of that, and it takes care of us. You know, it's funny to me how the buzzword these days is sustainability, and everybody acts like it's something new. That's what farmers have been doing for centuries. I mean, we're trying to be we want to be sustainable.
Sure.
You know, we need to take care of these natural resources we've been given, and if we abuse them, then they won't be here to take care of us.
Sustainability is one of those words that I wish we all had an agreed upon definition for.
Yeah, it depends on who you're talking to, what definition you get.
That's exactly right. Organic's another one of those words. Yeah. It depends on what state you're in is what those rules are.
Yeah. I was just told the other day that we no longer say GMO crops, where it's biotech now. So I was like, well, I have to change my, change my language here.
That sounds innovative.
Yeah.
That happens in our world too, in extension, you know, things change, reports change, and then it takes some of us. You can almost tell how long agents has been working by what they call a certain report, you know. I guess that happens in all of our arenas. But back to your point earlier, I had the opportunity to have a Farm City tour back just a few weeks ago, and in Webster County, it was our first one, and one of the things that you know, we talked about is that farmers and agriculturalists are typically the most environmental folks that you'll meet. That doesn't come across when you're removed from the farm, because we get a lot of negativity thrown our way and lots of things that are said that may not be true. But explain that the farmers, they really are environmental friendly. They really try really hard because there's less of you to produce more.
Yeah.
And the only way to be able to do that is to take care of what we have and to learn new technologies and new ways of doing things to be able to produce more with less.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those things that we can't say too much.
Right.
Is how farmers do, how they are good stewards of the ground that they have.
I was speaking with a group recently, and I was trying to tell them that farmers are really good at farming for the most part, but we're not really good at telling our story and telling how we do it. And we found ourselves in a position having to defend ourselves sometimes when I really don't feel like we should have to. But I mean, and you could say the same thing about school teachers, nurses, you know, but police officers, you know, all of a sudden you come under attack for some reason. It's because you've been at work doing your job. You haven't been out telling your story.
That's right.
Hopefully, you know, like, podcasts like this will be able to help do that and educate people about agriculture. And, you know, I've been coming by Micah and them's farm for years, you know, just years and years, well before Micah was born, actually. I'm going to tell my age here in a minute.
Me too.
But, you know, they've always been very progressive. One of the things I guess I notice more than anything, when they get ready to plant, they spend an enormous amount of time with their planters, making sure that they're going to get a quality stand. I mean, that's the one thing I can say about your dad. I've seen him out there digging around, and I mean, you may drive 30 or 40 feet and stop, and he'll be digging around for a long time to make sure that they're getting the stands that they need to get to be able to produce as much as they possibly can on what, you know, what land they have. So, you know, from a progressive standpoint, and then I've seen them over the years change, do some different things, try some different crops, and then Micah's kind of gotten into this strip tillage and the cover crop thing. So, Micah, tell us kind of a little bit about your cropping system and kind of, you know, kind of get into that a little bit and tell us about that.
Okay. Well, like I said, we grow corn, wheat, and soybeans currently. Our rotation right now is about 50-50 corn and then wheat and soybeans. So all of our soybeans are followed by wheat. They're all double crop. I'm sorry, they are following wheat, all double crop soybeans. We rarely have any full season beans anymore. So we've been on that rotation for quite a while now. We've been doing the cover crop, strip tillage, and controlled traffic. We kind of dove into all that close to 10 years ago. We went to RTK correction on all of our equipment, and that was necessary for the controlled traffic and everything. And and we didn't, I say we started all this at once, we started on it at once. We didn't really kind of have it all going the first year. And we're still trying to make it right. We're still learning what not to do, I think. So yeah, we have controlled traffic. All of our planters, our air seeders, our headers, they're all 40 foot. Our nitrogen applicators, everything's 40 foot. So it's all following the same traffic lane. All of our tracks are in the same place. And we're running pretty much all tracked equipment. So we don't have any duals, you know, any dual tires on anything. Now, you know, some of our fertilizer spraying equipment, stuff like that, it doesn't work out exactly right. But we try to time it to where it's out there at a time when the soil is very hard, you know, when we won't be getting a lot of compaction anyway. So sprayers are 80-foot or 120-foot. We've gone back and forth. So they can still follow in the same traffic pattern. And we're sticklers about it. I mean, I've got pictures. I've got a lot of drone pictures where you can see where the grain cart drives in the same place all the time, and he only gets over for them to dump, and then he gets right back in his traffic lane. We're just, we're really trying to, I don't want to say minimalize compaction, because we're compacting that area a lot, but we're trying to centralize the compaction. We're trying to, we want to know where the compaction is so we can treat that area differently. And we do try to treat that area a little differently. But that area is hard. It is. I mean, but you've seen that today's farm equipment. I mean, it's huge. It's getting bigger all the time. I don't see it getting any smaller right now. So we wanted to figure out a way to try to manage the compaction issues. We are cover cropping and strip tilling, and they're kind of, our strip tilling cover crop kind of go hand in hand. We have modified our, the strip till bar we use primarily as a coon krause. And we worked with Martin Industries down the road here in Elkton, a huge producer of, you know, aftermarket, you know, road cleaners and closing systems and fertilizer attachments, all kind of stuff for planters and whatnot. But they worked with us to incorporate a way to plant our cover crop at the same time that we're strip tilling, because we were having some issues. We were going out there and planting our cover crop with an air seeder that we had modified to where it only put the cover crop in between where the corn rows were going to be. We don't want that cover crop competing with our strip to our strip, because that's not a good situation in the spring. You know, we want that strip to be dry and warm, and you know, a cover crop growing in that strip is not
going to hold extra moisture.
It's not very conducive for that. So what they did was they helped us, and so we're sowing our cover crop between the strips that we're making. And we're using cereal rye right now. We've tried some other cocktails, and we may still try some in the future.
I was going to ask you kind of, you know, maybe just run through the gamut of all the different things that y'all have tried. And I know y'all kind of settled on cereal rye. To me, the growth on that is tremendous. And, you know, just kind of run through the gamut maybe of some of the stuff that y'all have tried that did you like. You know, obviously you like the cereal rye the best.
So... years ago, when we were doing some corn behind corn, which we don't hardly do any now, but we were doing some corn behind corn, and we would plant some radishes and do that behind the corn. Of course, our corn comes off, most of it's gone by September 20th, so it's still very warm outside. So we're out there planting cover crops, and we found that those radishes need to be planted early in order to get the growth going. Because once you get that first hard freeze, usually November, early December, they're kind of done. So you need to get some growth going. We really like that, but there's a couple things. We quit growing as much corn behind corn, and we started growing some canola, and the radishes and the canola started sharing. They share the same disease family. So that wasn't a good mixture. So we had to quit raising the radishes. Now, I like the radishes. I really do. If you can get them planted early, I like the radishes. But we could no longer get them planted early because our cover crop's falling beans. And we were growing the canola. So that kind of knocked that out. We've done some, we've done different things with oats. We've done a little bit with peas. But the cereal rye, and the main reason we stuck with cereal rye is it's root growth. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have 16, 24 inches above ground and have 36 to 48 inches of roots below ground. And we love what it does for breaking up compaction. We love what it does for just the infiltration of the soil, for water infiltration. Mm-hmm. Air moves better. You know, obviously the roots move better. So that's kind of where we stuck. I would like to do more. I'd like to get a legume in there. But sometimes it's kind of like, this is working. Don't mess it up.
Well, what about, and I know I'm fixing to say a really dirty word here, but what about ryegrass? You know, and crop folks are really, you know, they don't like to fool with ryegrass, but it does do similar to cereal rye when it breaks up that compaction and stuff. But I know from a cropping standpoint, it's probably not the best option.
You have to be careful with it. You have to really make sure when you go out there to terminate it, that you terminate it.
Right.
We used some this year, and I didn't touch on that. It's the first year we tried it, and it was hard to do because where we wanted it was in those traffic zones I was telling you about. Yep. So we wanted it there to try to break up that compaction. But we ran out of bin space on our Montag car that we pull behind our strip tiller. I mean, it looks like a train back there.
It does.
So, so we ran out of bin space. So we had to modify one bin. And Dad's great about coming up with these ideas. And he has great ideas. So he looks at me and says, "Now make it work." I'm like, okay, let's see what we can do here.
I can see that.
Yeah, I usually turn to my team. I'm like, "Hey, guys, can y'all make this work?" We did this on 800 acres, and we did get better root penetration there, and mostly throughout the year you couldn't tell the difference. Just driving by, you couldn't see it, but now it got to March, you know, ryegrass kind of has that kind of shine to it. You could start to see it then, and before it got too big, we said, okay, let's go kill it.
Let's kill it while we can,
before anybody sees it.
Exactly. I didn't exactly tell my neighbors I did that, but we killed it.
Well, I know, you know, sometimes some of that cereal rye is up around a foot tall or better before y'all terminate it, you know, that makes a difference.
As to how much root growth you have below
the soil.
And I go back and forth as to how big to let it get. Sometimes it get really big. You know, a lot of times we don't spray it until after we plant. So we're talking about middle of April, and we're out there spraying it. And it doesn't give us the trouble planting it because it's between the rows.
Right.
So it gives no trouble there. But sometimes when it dies and lays over the row,
I don't
like the way it makes the corn look. I'm not like going to say it hurts it. It makes it look like a mat, and the corn comes up looking a little spindly. So almost like Johnson grass. That's another bad word. But you know, kind of comes up looking a little spindly. So we've gone back and forth as to when to terminate. You know, what we're doing now, I think is working. But when you have that ryegrass out there, that annual rye, I'm on the side of let's kill a little earlier. You know?
Yeah, and especially with y'all being in the wheat country here, this is it's kind of tough to terminate that when you have wheat.
Yeah,
you know, and try to get it killed out of the wheat crop that you already have.
You can do it. Yeah. It's expensive.
Yes. Yeah. They've got some stuff for it. They got some chemicals for it.
You know, that's a good point to make about this part of the world, though. You were talking earlier about your all of your beans following wheat, the vast majority of it. You say you have very, very little full season beans now. That's really a lot of this whole area across the southern Pennyrhyl, is we don't see as many full season beans as what we did at one time. And that's primarily because it's good wheat production ground.
Right.
That's a whole lot of it.
Yep. 100%. I mean, you know, we're making really good yields behind our wheat. And I grew some full season beans a couple of years ago, and it's just kind of, we wanted to try some behind some cover crop, and we wanted to try something, and they made 5 or 8 more bushels. But you know, when you have double crop beans, you know, with a wheat crop, I mean, you know, economically, it has made a lot more sense to do the wheat beans than it does full season beans.
Folks outside of this area would be surprised at the double crop bean yields.
Oh yeah,
that a lot of people.
Sometimes
get in
I'm
this
surprised.
Area.
Well, both ways. I can be surprised both ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Year like last year, as dry as it was, that was probably one of those surprises.
But, you know, beans have proven to be one of those resilient crops. You just give them 2 or 3 rains in there, and they can do well. Even when you think, hey, it didn't get enough rain.
Yeah.
And you look up, and you've got 50 or 60 bushel beans. Like, God, how that happened?
That's one of the things about the double crop beans in this area, though. I've always thought, and a lot of people have agreed, that Labor Day is about that cutoff point, that if you don't have a rain by Labor Day, then you're not looking at much with those double crop beans. But one of the things that double crop management practice gives you is it allows you a later window into the summer, beginning of the fall to get that rainfall.
Yep. I agree.
You know, and the kind of the wheat crop this year was kind of like that. I thought the wheat crop was dead two or three times.
Yeah, we talked about
it. It should have been.
We talked about that. And it probably should have been. Yeah. But, I mean, my gosh, we had probably as good a wheat yields as we've ever had.
Everybody I've talked to had the best wheat they've ever had. Yeah. And I say the exact same thing you just said. I thought we killed it four different times.
Yeah.
You know, at one point, it's like, well, did we go out here and spray it all? You know, it got down to 17 and one night in the middle of March.
Right.
I mean, the wheat was pretty far along, and gosh, it just did amaze me.
Yeah. Went through, of course, it was planted in extremely, historically dry conditions.
Oh, yeah.
And then we had two freezes, at least, and then floods for some parts of the world before it was harvested.
Yeah, we have a certain date that we normally kind of look at, like, hey, we're not going to plant any wheat before now. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had everything ready to go. Corn was harvested, like, let's go ahead and start because the wheat's not going to come up. I mean, it's like planting out here in this rock driveway I have. It's like there's no moisture. So we started a few days earlier just to get it, it going.
I think I had planted some fescue up there, and it's about 6 weeks before it ever came up.
Yeah.
Because we never did get a rain.
Yeah, exactly.
But it laid there for 6 weeks, which I was really surprised that it did.
Yeah.
Until we had that freeze right before Christmas, basically we had a lot later window for that stuff to germinate and get started than we normally did, as far as like pastures, wheat, whatever you were seeding in the fall.
Yeah. I'd say everybody take another year like that on the wheat crop for sure.
I'll do it every year. Yeah. Sign me up.
That's right.
When you said you all had canola. Some, I've got a producer in Webster County that has canola, and he is really, he thinks, he's seen some benefits soil wise from the canola. And did you see those kind of those same things? I know you had a reason for why you had to move away from that and do a different rotation, but were you happy with the canola, or did you feel like that was a good rotation for you while it lasted?
We really were happy with it. It took more management. I will say it took more management, especially in the fall, because at the time you need to be planting it. It just took more. But we really liked it. We liked what it did for the soil. It had that taproot that came down. It was really, really good for our system. And the reason we quit growing, it wasn't anything agronomically.
Right.
It was it was an issue with the buyer.
Sure.
And they've tried to bring in some this industrial rapeseed since. Mm-hmm. And just some of the harvest stuff and the how we can deliver it, we just haven't been quick to jump back into it. I want to, but I'm afraid it's going to slow down our harvest. And we love the wheat, or I'm sorry, the beans behind the canola.
That's what they really like.
We were consistently getting 2 to 5 more bushels an acre.
That's it, what
the
my
canola.
Producers.
I mean, and it causes you some problems because you've got to keep it segregated.
Yep.
If you put it in the bin, you got to have a bin designated for that.
A bin that has a floor that'll hold.
That'll hold it. That's right.
You got to have a floor.
If you have a standard floor, canola will go through it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and if you'll find every little hole in your trailer.
Yeah.
I mean, because it will. That's the thing.
We always joke, we're standing there with a roll of blue paper towels and a roll of duct tape. As soon as you dump in a truck, just looking for places. And the same thing on headers, combines.
Yeah.
I would not take a wore out combine to a canola field because you're going to lose half your crop.
Yes. Yeah.
Mike, I know that you pretty progressive and talked about some drone stuff, and I've seen lots of videos on Facebook of some drone stuff. Do you do crop scouting? How do you use that kind of technology to help you in your farming operation?
So I won't lie. I use it mostly for cosmetic stuff for PR, to make posts about, hey, this is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I do use it some to scout. Feels like, when the corn gets big, or, maybe we had a storm go through and I need to see, hey, did any corn go down? I'll scout with that. We used to, either Dad or I, one would go up in a plane or a helicopter every year and to go out and look, hey, are there any vines coming up in the corn? Maybe get like a real wet summer, any vines coming up, anything we should spray for that nobody really wants to go out there and walk through, 10-foot tall corn all day. So the drone's been really good for that. I have been able to find some pigweed on some bean fields and stuff like that with it. Sometimes I find it accidentally when I'm out there, you know, goofing off with it, you know,
yeah.
you know, trying mm-hmm. to shoot a pretty picture. I'm like, what's that? And I was like, oh, that's a weed.
I didn't want to see that.
Yeah, I didn't want to see that. Let's not put that in the video.
Yeah.
Yeah, but my drone, the drone I have is several years old now, mm-hmm. and I need a better camera on it. But, you know, I'm really interested in these drones that spray. Mm-hmm. You know, that's becoming a new technology. And we haven't jumped into it yet. I think there's a place for it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Kind of like electric vehicles. I don't think all acres should be sprayed with drones. I don't think every vehicle should be electric. But mm-hmm. I think there's a place in the market mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. But
good way of putting that.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that you were on the corn growers as mm-hmm. well. And for any of our listeners that listen to us, you know, each week or several of our episodes, then you'll know that I guess we say get involved a lot. It's kind of a joke now between us three, but it is true, because back to what you said in the beginning, farmers are really good at farming. We're not so good at telling our story. Mm-hmm. We're not so good sometimes at taking that step into a leadership role and getting involved with these organizations. But they truly are important, and they are telling the story. They are the voice for agriculture and for farmers, and so it is important for folks that can, that they are taking advantage of that and being a part of that. And I know that you have done that, so just take a little bit of time here, if you don't mind, and just kind of tell us about your involvement on that, maybe even why you got involved in the first place,
and how you got
involved. Involved, and some things that you all have been working on here lately. I know that you all have been on a couple of business trips to, mm-hmm. you know, on behalf of the corn growers. And so just talk about that with us.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, so thank you for leading into that, because I think it's very important. And when I was younger, I didn't understand what the Kentucky Corn Growers or the Kentucky Soybean Association or, you know, Small Grain Association, mm-hmm. I didn't understand what those people did, you know, and Kentucky cattlemen's pork mm-hmm. producers. I don't care what you're talking about. These commodity, you know, I call them commodity groups. I'm going to come mm-hmm. on the
that's
animals.
What we do. We do too.
Commodity groups. That's what they do. Yep. They do so much work. You know, I thought, well, it's just some, you know, board meeting you go to a couple times a year and get a lunch and you leave. But when I went to my first Kentucky Corn Board meeting and saw the research that we were helping fund, mm-hmm. the legislation we were, you know, looking to push, I was like, now this is a board that I could get involved with that really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I understand that not everybody wants to, but you can help support these groups with, whether it be by checkoff or whatever. But these groups really are looking after the best interest of the corn farmer, the soybean farmer, wheat farmer, cattle farmer, you know, mm-hmm. pork farmer, whatever. You know, just 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C., what they call it, Corn Congress, which sounds a little corny. That's my joke for the day. But so we meet in D.C. and we go and visit with, I think we visit with almost every legislator we had in Kentucky that's in D.C. Yeah. And I don't care if they're on the same side of the aisle as what we're on or not. We want to meet with them. And you know, there was a new legislator up there from the Louisville area. Mm-hmm. And he was happy to meet with us. He didn't exactly know what we wanted to talk about, and mm-hmm. most of his constituents are not rural people, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. But he was super welcoming to us. He met with us in person. Some people have you meet with their staffers, especially mm-hmm. when they know they don't agree mm-hmm. with what you're coming to talk about. But it was Congressman Morgan McGarvey, and he was wonderful to meet with. But we met with
and it takes all those people.
It does.
Yes, it does.
You have to meet with all those folks.
That's
100%. It was great to meet with him. We met with our senators and their staffers, and some of the things we're talking about specifically, just so everybody out there knows what, you know, corn, you know, mm-hmm. Not only Kentucky corn, but national corn. Mm-hmm. This is all organized by the National Corn Growers Association. The Farm Bill, you know, very high on the list, talking about basically, let's keep these safety nets in place. We're not asking for anything. But please mm-hmm. don't take that stuff away. And the feeling we got from most people was, hey, a farm bill will be signed in. It will be, it may not happen in September, which I think is when the current one expires. It may be an extension. But mm-hmm. everybody had the feeling that it would be signed by December. and there wouldn't be a lot of changes as far as the safety nets for farmers. Mm-hmm. We talked about the Next Gen Fuels Act, and we talked to some people that were on those committees specifically talking about, let's get a hearing for this Next Gen Fuels Act. We think it could be great as far as increasing the corn grind. And I mean, we're not there just to increase the corn grind. I mean, you talk about sustainable. I mean, we have this fuel source right here that's grown in, I mean, almost every state in the U.S. And everybody wants to talk about, you know, clean energy, green energy, sustainability. But we have it, you know, so so we're pushing for that.
Absolutely.
And you know, and there's lots of people on the other side talking about the EVs, like we were just talking a minute ago, the, the electric vehicles. And we're not trying to push those out. There's a place in the market for them. But, you know, if I need to go haul anhydrous tanks tomorrow with my truck, it can't be electric. You know, it almost can't be gas. Some of that's diesel.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But, you know, just explain to those people, hey, electric doesn't work everywhere. I understand if you're in D.C. all the time and these people are commuting 3 miles to work every day, I see where electric works.
Mm-hmm. And the infrastructure's there for that.
Exactly. Yeah.
In rural Kentucky, it's not.
How many charging stations will you see on the way home?
None.
Exactly. Yeah. And people look at you a little funny when you say it, you know, if you're in Atlanta or Nashville or, you know, something like that. But, I mean, it just doesn't work around here.
Yeah.
But those were two of the biggest things that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And back in January, my wife and I had the opportunity to travel to Tunisia in Africa. And it was on behalf of Kentucky Corn, but we were with the U.S. Grains Council. And we were there because every year they do this, they call it the U.S. Corn Quality Rollout Meeting. So they meet with buyers. We were meeting with buyers there from Africa, the EU, the Middle East, and talking about the current quality of the U.S. corn crop. And they, the U.S. Grains Council goes all throughout the bigger corn producing states. They probably stay in the Midwest a lot.
Yeah.
But taking samples of the corn. And basically, they test it for starch content, you know, oil content, you know, all these different things, moisture damage, all these things that, because these different buyers aren't always buying it for the same thing. Some people are buying DDGs, some people are buying corn for feed, you know, they're buying a lot of different things. But it was really easy to, or it was really interesting to see. I sat down in that conference room where we're having the meeting the first day. And there's this huge row of booths in the back. I said, what's that for? They said, that's all the interpreters. So this is given in English, but it's interpreted in Arabic, French, and Spanish.
Wow.
And I was like, well. So if I saw somebody around me that had headphones on, I knew not to try to talk to them because they didn't speak English.
You knew you wasn't in Gracie, Kentucky anymore,
exactly,
didn't you?
Exactly. But, you know, I was over on the other side of the world seeing how these people are working to, working for the efforts of the U.S. corn farmer, you know, trying to open up new markets. We went to dinner one night, and I'm with this group of people, a lot of them I didn't know, and this guy leaned over me, and he said, hey, you're sitting across from the biggest buyer of DDGs in the world, from Turkey.
Really?
I said, oh, wow. And I met another guy from, I think he was from Spain. He wanted to know if I could ship him corn directly. I said, well, we may have to get somebody involved in the middle here. I don't have any barges or anything. I don't have any container or, you know, any large cargo ships. But it was just really interesting to see how they truly are working on the behalf of the U.S. Farmer, you know, trying to get us open up new markets.
Yeah. You know, I think we're really lucky in Kentucky, too, to have these commodity groups that work so hard for our farmers. You know, soybean board, corn growers, small grain growers, Cattlemen's Association, pork producers, you know, whatever the commodity group, we have a great group of leadership of those commodity groups here in Kentucky.
Absolutely. Every group. And I think a lot of people are surprised by Kentucky because, you know, a lot of times you think the Midwest, the I states, whatever. And then they see Kentucky like, hey, you guys are really involved. I'm like, well, yeah, we are. Yeah. And they don't realize how much agriculture there is in Kentucky.
Right.
And like you said, good agriculture. I mean, it's really progressive, good agriculture.
Yeah. Micah, talk a little bit about, you know, I know your involvement in the corn growers, and talk a little bit about, you know, the ethanol production and how that has come over the years, you know, how we've increased that, and maybe some legislation that, you know, you were talking a little bit about the Next Gen deal. So talk with us a little bit about, you know, ethanol and what it can do for our farmers.
Well, gosh, ethanol, it hits close to home here because we have an ethanol plant right here in Hopkinsville. Mm-hmm. And the majority of our corn goes there. It doesn't all go toward ethanol, but it goes up to Hopkinsville Elevator. Then a lot of that will go to the ethanol plant. My grandfather was on the board, the first original board for the ethanol plant, and he's no longer on there now. But it's just it's really neat to see how it came about. Kentucky corn growers were some of the first investors in the plant, and you talk about taking money that has come from corn farmers trying to invest it to open up new markets. That's been a heck of a market for corn farmers. Yeah. And we've since sold our shares, and it all belongs to Hopkinsville Elevator now. But, I mean, that's just something wonderful that they've done.
And that's part of what checkoff dollars are all for, is to be able to get those new markets up and going. And, you know, and like you said, they've since bought you out. But without their initial investment, been hard to do some of those things.
100%. You know, some people look at that settlement sheet and all they see is that checkoff that came out. And I understand nobody wants to see money come out, but if you're ever concerned, I would challenge you to reach out to somebody and say, somebody that's on a board or is involved, and say, hey, what's this money going for? I guarantee you they can tell you very quickly. And if they can't, that should be a red flag. But they should be able to tell you very quickly what that money's going for, because I can tell you with a straight face, it's used, honestly, it's used very conservatively to try to help Kentucky corn farmers. It really is. And it's time to say the same thing for the Soybean Association. I mean, I'm members of all this. I may be a member of the cattlemen. I don't have any cattle. I don't know. But all these associations are very active and have a loud voice in Frankfort, have a loud voice in Washington, D.C.
I know back in March we did this show with Joseph Sisk, and he made the exact same statement. He said, reach out. If you're wondering where your checkoff dollars goes, reach out. He said, just make a phone call. There will be somebody in that office that will dedicate the time to answering your questions.
They will flood you with paperwork, with emails, and somebody will be at your door, wanting to talk to you. But we can definitely show you where the money goes.
And they do a great job educating people, non-farm folks, about where their checkoff dollars go and how to invest it and what these products are used for, why corn is so important to Kentucky, why soybeans are so important. All of these commodities that do a great job educating the public. And that's kind of what we do, and we feel like that's really important. And, you know, Mike, I heard you say a while ago, you were talking about a little PR for the farm. You were using your drone for more for that. I think we need more of that. I don't think we have enough people that are doing that to tell their story.
I agree 100%. And I'm not very good at it. I have some friends who are much better than I am. They're, updating their farm Facebook page every day and showing what's going on. To me, sometimes I think, people don't care what I'm doing. This is silly. So I never want to come across as, hey, look what I'm doing over here. But I think the public really does care about what's going on the farm. I really think they do. So I try to do it around harvest, around planting, and people love the drone videos.
I've watched them all, so I can tell you.
I made a post the other day about sweet corn. Sweet corn's a big time for us. We give away all our sweet corns. So that's always a fun time. Just farmers are really good at farming. We got to get better at telling our story.
That's something we learned pretty quick with social media. I think a lot of producers use that as an opportunity for relations with their landlords, with some of the farms that they work. But it quickly has become a tool for telling our story if folks would get out and do that more. And telling the right story. There's a lot of stories out there that we see that we'd love to correct. We'd love to do better. And that's one of the lessons we can learn from that too.
Kentucky corn, a lot of the checkoff, and I say a lot, a certain percentage of the checkoff money goes toward education. And we have stuff where we educate teachers, and the teachers can educate the children. Because, anymore, a lot of the children aren't raised on a farm. It's different from what was 50 years ago. So chocolate milk doesn't come from brown cow. sometimes you just got to go out and educate them on what's, what the truth is. And we feel like we feel strongly enough about it that we invest in it.
I think there's a lot of those commodity groups that do the exact same thing. There's the dairy folks. They do some. They've got a trailer that they send to different schools and things to try to educate kids. It's all about getting younger people to understand where their food comes from before they get older and biased and don't understand and don't want to really learn.
Or don't care, right.
Right. You know, and all your groceries, they, you know, all the milk and the, you know, cereal and everything just doesn't come from the grocery. There's a place that it actually originates, and, you know, our Kentucky farms are one of them.
And I think, you know, our consumers, our end users, whatever word we want to use on that, a lot of them do want to understand where farmers are coming from or why farmers do the things they do. You know, even trying to understand the new technologies and the, you know, like, you know, when Roundup Ready came out, you know, and just it was, I think it's our part of our job is to let those folks know why we're doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of times we don't do that, and then somebody else is going to come up with a reason why we're doing it, and it's probably not the right reason.
Yep.
And so many times it's a scare tactic kind of thing, and it's just understanding those types of things. And our consumers, a lot of times, if we just talk to them and explain it, they'll be like, "Gosh, I didn't know that. That's very interesting." You know, especially I know us as agents, sometimes we'll get, you know, questions about different things. And after you have a conversation with them and explain it, you know, they have a whole new outlook on it. And I know that's not the case all the time, but the vast majority it is. And I think education is key. I'm glad that all of our commodities organizations, you know, they really are important. They really do a lot of work with education. And you talked about it when you said you sat down at your first meeting and saw all the research that you were funding. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that these commodity groups are so supportive of is funding that research, because the research that these universities are doing it's not free.
No.
And it takes a tremendous amount of money to do the research, and just the support of our commodity organizations here in Kentucky, the support that they give for that research, that speaks volumes of what their goals are and how that's, I mean, because they want to support agriculture. They want to support farmers, and to do that education, supporting that education through research is important, and it's a priority.
Yep.
I think, you know, as we sit down with consumers, I think that the biggest problem we have is a time factor. You know, folks just don't have time anymore. You know, I can remember when I was a kid sitting around my grandparents or sitting around with people that would stop by and would just talk.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen anymore.
No.
We don't have any of that anymore. Yeah. So using the outlets that like Micah's using on Facebook to show those videos and these podcasts and any other kind of way.
Sure.
Our friend Alan Watts has the Morning Ag Report. And I mean, you know, and I used to hear from people all the time that didn't have any agriculture. They listen to the Morning Ag Report. They want to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so using those types of media and to get the word out, I think we just got to keep plugging.
Well, and I think just like for an example, just because a lot of times if you watch TV at night, you know, if you've ever used this product, those kinds of things, and then it gets that mindset in that, oh my goodness, the pesticides that are being used, it's killing us.
Yeah.
But if we would just tell the process that they have to go through before that product can ever be labeled for use. Mm-hmm. I mean, the time and the money that goes through to be able to get that product labeled and why we have to use it.
Yeah.
That's the part that we leave out, is what happens if we don't use these? We can no longer produce the food and the fiber that this growing population needs.
Yeah.
Then what are we going to do?
I talked to my son about that just last week. He's junior in college right now, and if you want to know where all the propaganda machines are working, it's on college campuses, because they know that's the last opportunity they have to catch people. They're just out of under the wing of their parents' home, but they hadn't quite hit the free world
yet. I'm getting ready to send my daughter, don't tell me this.
Well, I mean, you know, he comes home to asking questions because he hears stuff, and, you know, he knows that's not what he's heard growing up.
Yeah.
We had a long, long talk about building your business on the back of somebody else. And one of the things that I hate to see from some agricultural commodity groups, not corn, soybeans, or wheat necessarily, but some of these groups that advocate for sustainable ag, they call it, or organic or all natural, is that they want to condemn conventional agriculture to build their own business.
Yep.
And I absolutely deplore that. One, if your business is good enough, it'll go out and earn its keep.
Yep.
I believe in a free market, and yep. I believe that's the way it is. But above and beyond that, when we think about, you know, the decisions we make and the choices we make and the type of foods we want to eat, when I look at the land mass around our country and around the rest of the world and know the population that there is out there to be fed, I know there is no way that we can feed the world. And that's exactly what we're doing in conventional mm-hmm. agriculture. There is no way we can feed the world by going backwards in our management practices. Mm-hmm. If we do away with commercial fertilizers, if we do away with you know, different herbicides or insecticides, that's exactly what we're doing, is taking a step backwards. And we're not efficient in producing that away, and we're not going to be able to keep up with the food needs of the world by doing that.
Yeah, and one thing I didn't touch on that we spoke about when we were in Washington was thanking a lot of the legislators for pushing for the, I don't know what you call it, a hearing or whatever, but we have the USMCA agreement, you know, the agreement between the United States, Mexico, mm-hmm. and Canada, mm-hmm. and the Mexican president, and by the way, you know, Mexico is our number one or number two buyer of U.S. corn.
I think number one.
Yeah,
now,
I think they go back and forth, but yeah, so they're huge. When their president came out and said, oh, we're not going to buy any GMO corn. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what do you mean you're not going to buy any GMO corn? And then he stepped back and said, well, we're not going to buy any for human consumption. Mm. Like, what, do you understand that your people, if they start getting hungry, that this mm-hmm. is not going to be good for you?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But people think it sounds good, it makes them feel good. And I don't understand it. At the end of the day, that would drastically increase. It would decrease the supply, and the price is going to go up.
Yep.
You know, so I wouldn't think he'd have very many of his constituents very happy with him when corn mm-hmm. price goes up for the tortillas. Yep.
I used to speak to high school students in a leadership group, and we would have an agriculture day. And the very first thing that I would tell them is, you know, we get to talking about different farming systems and things like that, and then, you know, we talk about organic farming, and they would kind of be interested in that. And I said, I'm gonna tell y'all something. I said, if every farmer in the United States went to organic farming, you'd starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You would just absolutely starve to death. So we've got to have these technologies that we have to be able to do, to feed the world. I mean, we're really feeding the
world. And it's like what he said early on. There's a place for that.
There's a place.
There is a place for organic production. There is a place for that. And we are in no way saying that that is a negative thing. But it is. It's just not realistic to believe that we can feed the world and not use the technologies that we have been using and the new technologies that will continue to come.
Yeah, and that's where the education part comes in. You have to educate these people on this, because I don't think they're evil. They're not trying to be like, oh, we want to put you out of business.
Right.
They just don't understand that if you try to tell everybody you had to be an organic farmer, that's not going to work.
No.
Is there room for it in the marketplace? Absolutely there is. There's room for EVs. There's room for lots of things.
Yep.
But you can't just say, this is better, this is what everybody should do.
We can use, right in Christian County, the produce auction, which is one of the largest in the eastern United States, is not, and they do not advocate large-scale organic production. They are 100% commercial sales. They'll use pesticides, they'll use fertilizer, because they know that's how they're going to be able to keep up with the demand for their product.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Back when I worked with that group a lot, they had organic buyers come in and say, you know, they'd do presentations for the farmers. They'd say, if you want to get into a market where you're going to cut your production by 35% or 40% and increase your you know, net by 7 or 8, yeah, let's go that route. but who wants to do that?
Yeah.
Nothing in the world uglier than an organic tomato, I'll say. with bug holes and sunspots and everything else in it.
But like I said, there is a segment of our population that likes that, and there's a place for them in the marketplace.
Sure.
If you talk to those people that are doing that, they're doing that because that's what they feel they need to do, and they can tell you why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oftentimes, though, what we see is somebody is just jumping on that bandwagon, so to speak. But when you say, well, why, you know, and not trying to be argumentative or trying to change their mind, just have a conversation like we are around this table, is just, you know, what is it about this particular topic? And if it's organic, you know, what is it about that that you're drawn to that, well, then where the conversation mm-hmm. stops right there, because they don't understand the difference between organic or conventional or whatever topic we're talking about.
Yep.
So just do the education, then make the decision that's best for you.
Yep.
You know, there's a, like I said, it's they all have their place.
Yep. Education is so important, and we can't stress that enough on this program. But education is so important for our consumers and for our farmers even. You know, we need to know where our checkoff dollars are going and what mm-hmm. they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And as on the other side of the aisle, we know those folks need to know how we produce these products and why we produce these products and that type of thing. And that we're providing the safest, the most abundant, you know, food supply in the world is coming from the United States and the cheapest.
Well, that's the point because when you look at the vast majority of our consumers out there, they're price point shoppers.
Yeah.
And they're going to buy what's within their budget. It may sound good to buy something else, but they're going to buy what's within their budget.
Absolutely.
So. And I think as farmers too, if folks are asking you know, the practices that you're doing, you know, don't be scared to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, explain why you're doing what you're doing. And if we, you know, this is why we do it. This is what happens if we don't.
Yep.
And don't be afraid to, you know, kind of stand up for what you're doing.
That's right. Don't be afraid to get involved.
That's right.
Yeah, that's
right. Get involved.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Well, you know, we always, towards the end of our show, we like to have a timely tip that's either relative to the season that we're in or the information that we're providing. And we talked a lot today about cover crops. We talked a lot about your strip tillage and how you've worked to make that fit the operation that you needed. So we think a good timely tip for this week is to remind producers just to be innovative and to be willing to try new things. There are a lot of different tillage practices out there, cover crop practices that folks can try and see if they could make them work in their operation. And I think that's the tip today, is just to be willing to step out and try something new.
Oh, I think that's 100% correct. And, you know, the good thing about Micah is if somebody was interested in doing that, I guarantee you he would talk to them.
Absolutely.
He'd be glad to visit with them about it.
Hey, having worked in this county for a long time, I know that to
lots
be true.
Of folks,
he mentioned the group that he spoke to earlier today. That entire group, the Christian County Agribusiness Association, is full of people. The whole reason they get together and meet once a month and have lunch is to share information and to have a short educational program.
Yeah.
So
I guarantee they'd get together. He'd help them.
And
sure.
Sometimes it's good to know what not to do.
Yeah, that's as important.
If he's already tried it.
If you've already
right.
tried
yeah.
it and
yeah.
it doesn't work,
yeah.
you
I
know,
think
you're
I can sell that
hide.
Better.
You're not
let me, you know, I'll tell you what to do, but let me tell you what not to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me save you some time and some aggravation and maybe a little money by this doesn't work.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Well, Michael, we appreciate you sitting down today. Say hi to your dad for me. I hadn't seen him in a good while, so we want to say thanks to you and thanks for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.